13-25-00016-CB, San Benito Economic Development Corporation, Inc., et al. Versus Varco Real Estate, San Benito, LLC.
Good morning. May it please the court. As I said, my name is Robert Drinkard, and I am here representing all of the appellants in this case, of which there are many, the San Benito EDC, every member of the San Benito City Commission, every member of the San Benito EDC Board, and two San Benito EDC employees. There are two issues with this appeal. One is an injunction that was granted that we believe was an abuse of discretion. The second issue is a plea to the jurisdiction, which was denied.
So I went over your briefs over and over and over again, and I thought I saw just issue one, and that is the issuance of the injunction, and could barely find anything regarding the denial of the plea to the jurisdiction.
Oh, it's there. it was actually issue number one. It's only in the EDC's brief, though, not in the end of, because we filed two different briefs, one for the individuals and one for the EDC. So that you'll find the plea to the jurisdiction only in the first brief.
Is there any disagreement as to whether it's a type B or type A?
There is not. Okay. There's not.
So you believe you're entitled to some form of immunity regarding some of the causes of action?
Correct. The plea to the jurisdiction, the only immunity issues that we're claiming there are as to the intentional torts. I think it's clear from the Rosenberg EDC case that that door is shut when it comes to breach of contract claims, which is why we didn't file a plea to the jurisdiction until they amended to add the intentional torts. And I'll start with the plea. That's probably what y'all are more interested in. I'll start with the plea. The case law in this court since 2006 has been, and that was City of Weslaco versus Bourne, and I'm dating myself because that was my case, is that EDCs, whether type A or type B, have immunity from intentional torts. And that comes from the statute that says they are governmental entities for purposes of the Tort Claims Act.
So which causes of action survive?
Which ones survived in that case?
No, in your case here, because I know that there's several torts that you're referring to, but then there's some other breach of contract and others. I just want to know which ones survive and are subject to the plea.
The breach of contract claims will survive. I mean, they're not at issue here. So the only two intentional torts that were challenging, they claim joint enterprise, which I don't really think is a tort in and of itself, but it's tortious interference with contract and it's civil conspiracy, which are intentional torts. The plea is only challenging those claims.
Okay.
And
now you bring up Chapter 505 of the Local Government Code, but in your brief, you don't discuss or talk about the dichotomy of governmental versus proprietary. In this case, in order for liability to be immune from liability in this case, don't you have to prove that there were a governmental function is involved in this case?
I don't believe so. I think that only applies to cities. There has been no case law that applies the proprietary governmental distinction to an EDC or to any other type of governmental entity other than a municipality.
But then why would the legislature specifically state that the immunity under Chapter 505 arises from the performance of a governmental function?
Yeah, I think what it's saying there, it's shutting down that governmental proprietary distinction. It's saying everything that EDCs do are governmental functions. So it's saying you don't even have to get to that analysis because they can only perform governmental functions. So that's why I don't think the proprietary governmental distinction even comes into play with an EDC, at least under the statutory 505-106B.
Okay.
So again, the law has been in this circuit and elsewhere that EDCs, type A or type B, have immunity from intentional torts. And there really was no controversy about that until where you started to see cracks was people were bringing immunity claims for breach of contract. And then you started to see cracks in the armor on that. And ultimately what happened is a breach of contract claim went up in the Rosenberg EDC case. And it was only a breach of contract claim. The court below in that case even said, there's really no dispute here that EDCs are immune from intentional torts. The plaintiffs didn't cross appeal that issue. So the only thing that went up was a breach of contract. And the court in Rosenberg even says this, what we're here to decide is breach of contract immunity. What happened, what ended up happening, and it wasn't briefed, is that the Supreme Court issued some somewhat sweeping statements where it said, well, EDCs are not governmental entities for purposes of immunity. And even though their intentional tort issue wasn't before them, I think that kind of threw everybody for a loop. Or is the door being shut here by the Supreme Court in Rosenberg EDC as to immunity for all claims? And this has been an issue. I mean, all the government law nerds like myself that go to these conferences have talked about this. I don't think it does. That's why we're here. This is not the first case where it's gone up on intentional torts, because I don't think it shuts the door. The reason for that is that wasn't an issue in Rosenberg EDC. It's essentially either an advisory opinion or dicta, because they weren't analyzing immunity within that context. And I know there's been a case, the Hitchcock EDC case out of Houston, that basically said, well, the Supreme Court said what it said, and we kind of have to go along with it. But even in Rosenberg, you see a concurring opinion by Justice Hecht. And he says, look, I agree with y'all on the breach of contract part, but that's the only claim up here. Why are y'all jumping to intentional torts and application of the Tort Claims Act? Because we're not even here to talk about that. And he basically does say, if we are, I think that they are immune, because the Tort Claims Act, it's not just about immunity from liability. I mean, the Tort Claims Act has immunity from suit in it. It has immunity from liability, damages, and it has an election of remedies provision. And if the Supreme Court is just reading that out and saying, well, 505-106B basically just means you're only immune from liability, then that changes the game, because now what happens to the immunity from suit provisions that are in the Tort Claims Act? They're essentially just read out. And I think had the Supreme Court had that issue before them and had it been briefed, we probably would have seen a different opinion, or at least some of the stray comments would have been different. So I don't believe the door is shut. I do believe that City of Weslaco versus Bourne, and I think this is the first time this issue has come up in this court since Rosenberg, I think it is still good law. There's probably a circuit split now based on what the Hitchcock Court of Appeals said. I think if this court were to hold that, Rosenberg doesn't change anything in terms of intentional torts, it probably widens the circuit split. But frankly, I think the Supreme Court is going to have to clarify this at some point. I think it's going to go up to them several times until they take this issue up specifically with an intentional tort claim before them to allow for an analysis of that statute, 505-106B. And that is, Justice Theory, and I apologize if it was confusing, because we did file, there's a lot of briefing and multiple briefs. But
well, I think that's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
There were several amended briefs, and I probably, for the purpose of preparation, probably missed one of them.
Okay.
I did notice that in the appellee's brief, they addressed the plea of the jurisdiction at length, so.
So I don't believe that this court would be thumbing its nose at Supreme Court precedent. I wouldn't be here asking y'all for a ruling that the EDC is still immunity if I thought that Supreme Court precedent was binding on an intentional tort issue. I wouldn't be wasting anybody's time. I do think that it's leaving a huge issue out there unresolved if everybody just says, well, the Supreme Court made these sweeping statements, so the issue is dead. Because that is not allowing for an analysis of the statute before the Supreme Court. So I think City of Weslaco versus Bourne is still good law. So, and I mean, if y'all have any more questions, I'll jump to the injunction briefly. We think there was a whole host of issues with the injunction, the granting of injunction, that constitutes an abuse of discretion. It didn't just enjoin the EDC. It enjoined every one of the individuals that's in this case, none of whom were served with process, the lawsuit, or notice of the injunction hearing before the injunction hearing was held. They simply didn't notice them.
Weren't two of them?
Two of them got a subpoena to appear as witnesses at the hearing, and they showed up pursuant to that subpoena. And then suddenly now they're in the box because the court's saying, well, you're here. The case law, though, says even if you're aware of an injunction hearing, You don't have a duty to defend if you didn't get proper notice.
So the appellees assert that because these are agents of the city, then when the city is served, then they're also served. I think that's one of the arguments.
And the confusing part about that is they served the city secretary with all of the citations. Most of these people are not even associated with the city. I mean, you've got the EDC board. It's not even associated with the city. You've got EDC employees. But even the city commissioners, you can't serve notice to a city commissioner of a lawsuit. It requires personal service unless you do alternative service. And they never did that. And the process server admitted he didn't do that. He just dropped him off with the city secretary and basically walked out. So we think there's no dispute. They didn't get notice. The two folks that did show up, I don't believe they should have been put in that box to defend themselves. They didn't have an opportunity beforehand. They were there pursuant to a subpoena to be witnesses, and then suddenly are there being told this injunction hearing is asked to you.
How do you respond to Appelli's argument that it wasn't appropriate that the trial attorney argued a special appearance at that time? It's more likely a general appearance.
I mean, I was the trial attorney, so to be candid, the way the rule reads, that's probably right. But I think it goes back to it prejudiced those folks because I didn't have a choice because they were there and the court was going to go forward against them. I do think they're probably right that under the rule, the special appearance, general appearance thing, but I don't think we had an opportunity to do that because they didn't get the proper notice that would have allowed them on the spot to basically go forward with the specific general notice. I mean, we were really kind of boxed in there. So I think they're reading the statute correctly, but I don't think it should apply in this circumstance because of the prejudice that it caused them having to be there and suddenly defend despite never having even noticed. They didn't even know they were going to be there, put in that injunction box. So I disagree with them on that. That issue is only as to those two individuals. All the rest of them weren't even there, didn't get notice, didn't appear, and they all got enjoined. I mean, we're talking 12, 13 people that were enjoined that never even showed up because they weren't told to. They didn't have notice to. So
looking at the reporter's record as to what happened when the court denied the plea jurisdiction, you mentioned that you're going to appeal. And then later on, you state in the affirmative that an appeal has been filed, and then the court rescinds its order.
Right?
Can you give us a timeline of exactly how it happened? Because I can see the file stamp copy of the notice, but looking at the record, I can't tell what happened when.
Yeah, and it was boom boom. So we did have the plea set the same day, which I was glad about, and the court did take up the plea first. We argued it, and the court verbally said, I'm going to deny it, and I was right there ready to file the denial of plea. Plaintiff's lawyers, no, Judge, don't deny it. I mean, this is all happening at the same time. Don't deny it yet. Let us put on the injunction evidence, because they knew what was about to happen. They knew I was going to file a plea. So before I could actually file a plea, and I had my legal assistant there ready to file, the judge said, no, okay, you're right. I'm not denying it. I'm going to take it under advisement. Let's go forward with the injunction hearing. So what I did at that point, because I had two notices prepared, I thought maybe that would happen, is I still filed a notice of appeal, but one that said, well, you're implicitly denying it. Because you're making us go forward with this injunction hearing without ruling, you have implicitly denied our plea. And I did urge the objection that we shouldn't go forward because I filed that on the spot. And the judge said, well, I'm sorry, we're going forward anyway. And then we had the injunction hearing, which lasted several hours. And then as soon as that was over, the judge said, all right, now I'm denying the plea. So it was all, right at the same time. So I do think it's setting a dangerous playbook for how lawyers are going to do when they get these injunction hearings and there are jurisdictional issues. They're just going to go in and tell judges, don't rule yet. You can hear it, but don't rule so they can get their injunctions in place. And then those are going to sit while the jurisdictional issues wind their way through the appeal process. So I do think it's a dangerous precedent, which is what we've tried to avoid. That's what happened here. I think that also ties into the abuse of discretion with going forward with the injunction hearing, despite the fact that we had filed an implicit denial appeal. So, you know, and I'm running out of time here. I mean, and this is in the brief. The injunction, I mean, it enjoined everybody basically for everything. There was essentially almost no evidence put on at the injunction hearing related to all these individuals. I mean, they didn't come up. Their names didn't even come up. One of the injunction aspects is as to a stop work order that the city issued, not the EDC, not any of these individuals, the city of San Benito.
You can address that in your 5 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Whenever you're ready.
Okay. May it please the court. Again, my name is Ricardo Pomarojo. I'm here on behalf of the Appalee. I'm generally going to follow the same line of argument as Mr. Drinkard here. Start with the plea to the jurisdiction, because I think that's the more important of the two, to be honest. And then whatever time I have left, I'll go ahead and I'll address the temporary injunction. We have two arguments for why the plea to the jurisdiction was denied. Actually, before I get into that, Chief Justice Tejerina, you asked about the claims that we still had left, or you know, that weren't being affected. And so VARCO had claims for declaratory action, breach of contract, quantum merit, Chapter 245, and tortious interference. Tortious interference was the only tort claim we had. I know he mentioned civil conspiracy. We view that not as a claim, but as a theory of liability.
Do you agree that those that they do have immunity for those intentional torts, whatever they may be?
No, our position is they got no immunity.
Okay.
After Rosenberg. And so what I want to do is I want to discuss Rosenberg at length to make sure this court has an understanding of it. And so our position is, one, under Rosenberg, there is no immunity anymore, period. Whether you're a type A, whether you're a type B, no matter what the claim is, there is no immunity. But even if you were to disagree with me on that, we have a secondary argument, which says the SBEDC brought various counterclaims, and our position is that those counterclaims changed the contours of immunity and opened up the SBEDC to our tortious interference claim. But first, let me get on Rosenberg. So in order to understand Rosenberg, let's first start off with how it developed at the Court of Appeals. It was at the 14th Court of Appeals. And so what you had was a Type B EDC, Rosenberg was, and you had a trial court that partially denied a plea to the jurisdiction. There was various breach of contract claims. It denied the plea to jurisdiction as to some theories of breach of contract, granted as to others. Both sides could have appealed, but RDC was the only party that appealed that partial denial of the plea to the jurisdiction. And so it gets to the Houston 14th Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals affirms the trial court's ruling. And it says in there, okay, EDCs, you do not have immunity from breach of contract claims. But in addition to saying that, it also goes out of its way to say that EDCs, you do have immunity from tort claims. That's in there. So in Rosenberg, the 14th Court decided, you know what, we're going to draw a line. And we're going to say breach of contract claims, no immunity. And another set of that line, any kind of tort claims, immunity. So it goes up to the Supreme Court. RDC takes it up to the Supreme Court petition for review. And so what the Supreme Court decides to do is say, let's discuss whether there's even a line there to begin with, because that's what the appellate court is saying, that there's a line there. Let's discuss if a line even exists. And the Supreme Court makes it incredibly clear that they are talking, when they address immunity and the existence of it, they're talking about any kind of EDC and they're talking about any kind of claims. And so if you look at Rosenberg, the Supreme Court's opinion, you read the statement of facts, the factual background, and at the very end, after it's stated all the facts, and this is, I'm quoting this, it says, we granted RDC's petition for review to address whether economic development corporations or governmental entities immune from suit, period, full stop. If you look at that sentence, there's nothing in there saying, well, we granted review so we could determine if you have immunity from breach of contract, or we granted review so we could look at specifically type A or type B. None of that's in there. They're saying up front, we're gonna look at the whole thing, whether you're A or B, whether it's tort or contract, we're gonna look at it. And they keep on repeating this language throughout the opinion. I'm going to read you another excerpt. And when they get into the discussion section, they say this, and I'm quoting here. The threshold issue on appeal here is whether RDC is immune from suit under the common law, even though RDC is neither a sovereign entity nor a political subdivision of the state. The threshold issue on appeal here is whether the EDC has immunity. Again, there's no distinction between we're going to only be discussing this type or that type. There's no distinction as to contract or tort. And then again, after it makes its, it makes all its, goes through all the statutes and makes its determination, they say this: we conclude that the legislature did not authorize municipalities to create economic development corporations as distinct governmental entities entitled to assert immunity in their own right. Okay, so those are three quotes where the Supreme Court is very clearly telling you what it's doing, that it's looking at immunity in its entirety.
So you think Rosenberg eliminated that line between contracts and torts?
Absolutely. And so, and he correctly, you know, Mr. Drinker correctly points out there was a concurrence that Justice Heck wrote where he says, you know what, frankly, in my opinion, I would give immunity to torts, to EDCs. But that is a disagreement that he is expressing to the majority. And by the way, none of the other justices joined Chief Justice Hecht in that concurrent opinion. And so he was expressing disagreement with the broadness in which the majority had said, you know, there's no immunity. But he couldn't call it a dissent because at the end of the day, I mean, this issue had nothing to do, it didn't directly relate to RDC's issue about whether or not it was immune from contractual liability.
But then there's also the distinction of being immune from suit and immune from liability.
Absolutely.
In this case, the Rosenberg case, it specifically, Justice Guzman specifically states that the decision is concerning liability, I mean, immunity from suit, not immunity from liability. So even if we agree that Rosenberg just forecloses the idea that that tort claims are considered like breach of contract claims for filing suit, what about the liability issue?
Correct. But that hasn't developed yet. I mean, the immunity from liability protects governmental entities from money judgments, and we're not there yet. So, I mean, that what you're hitting on could definitely become an issue should we go back and Varco gets a judgment in its favor on perhaps, you know, this tort claim. Absolutely.
And the EDC's plea to jurisdiction specifically stated that they're immune from liability and filed their plea on that basis, and there was no response on the record that I could find.
I don't see how you could argue immunity from liability from just the money damages in the plea to the jurisdiction. I mean, from my recollection, this is purely focused on immunity from suit. That's what I remember seeing in their plea to the jurisdiction that was filed. As to whether or not I've missed something and they broadened it on the appellate level, I can't say. But, you know, what was before the trial court, we were immune from suit. Now, have I answered your question, Judge?
Yes, thank you.
An important case to look at here is the Hitchcock case. That's another 14th Court of Appeals opinion. This is a really interesting opinion. So in Hitchcock, they're dealing with type A EDCs. Here we're type B, all right? In Hitchcock, though, they discuss Rosenberg, and they make it clear in Hitchcock, for purposes of immunity analysis, there's no difference between type A and type B. And they say that in Rosenberg, and I'll quote it here. It says, although Rosenberg involved a type B economic development corporation, Rosenberg's reasoning and analysis apply with equal force to a type A economic development corporation. And so it's also vice versa. Whatever you say about type B applies to type A, it goes both ways. And so the reason Rosenberg is interesting is because it comes from the 14th Court of Appeals, and that is the exact same court. The Hitchcock is interesting because it's the exact same court that was involved in Rosenberg. All right. So in Rosenberg, the 14th Court of Appeals, before it got to the Supreme Court, they said, we're of the view that EDCs have immunity from tort. And now here the issue is coming to them again. In Hitchcock, And you have a an EDC here that's claiming immunity from a fraud claim. And what the court says is, look, after Rosenberg, this is over. There is no immunity from tort. There's no longer a split here. As far as we're concerned, whatever split that you're looking at pre-Rosenberg, those cases are gone, including its own case, where, again, in Rosenberg, it said there was tort immunity. And it's interesting because the judge who wrote the opinion in Hitchcock also wrote a concurring opinion. And in that concurring opinion, he expresses a view that he thinks that EDCs shouldn't have immunity from tort claims. And even though he believes that, he says, I'm stuck. You know, there's no other proper way to read Rosenberg other than to read it as it has closed the doors on all types of, you know, our claims of immunity from suit. And that's interesting. And what's more interesting is that the EDC that was at issue in Hitchcock was represented by Mr. Drinkard's firm. And if you look at those appellate briefs, the same arguments that are being raised to this court, saying you got to narrowly read Rosenberg, were made to the 14th court in Hitchcock. And the Hitchcock disagreed and said, no, you're wrong. I mean, you read Rosenberg, it's very broad. It shuts the door on all kinds of arguments about immunity.
Can you also talk about, you cite two subsequent Texas Supreme Court cases, City of League City and CPS Energy. They were both handed down in 2023. That's on page 36 of your brief.
Thank you for that.
Talk about those and elaborate a little bit more as in terms of, are they just a continuation of what the holding was in Rosenberg, or can you explain a little bit more?
Yeah. First, let me say that I don't think these cases are nearly on point as the Hitchcock case that I've been talking about, and that's why I discuss Hitchcock more in my brief. But I do think that these cases are endorsing a view that Rosenberg shouldn't be read narrowly, and specifically on page 36, the very first bullet point, the Cy Monahan's Brother Hospital versus Monahan's Economic Development Corporation, you know, that case as well contains language saying, you know, Rosenberg used to be read more broadly. But to be honest, I don't recall too much of the facts of these cases, which I didn't discuss
that's,
as much. I apologize.
Fine.
But the next issue is, even if you disagree with me on Rosenberg, or if you just want to avoid the Rosenberg debate, you can easily still affirm the denial of the plea of the jurisdiction on the basis that they brought forth counterclaims. And what we're relying on is Riata Construction Corporation versus City of Dallas. And in that case, the Supreme Court says that there's no immunity from claims that are germane to, connected with, and properly defensive to the governmental entity's claims, to the extent the opposing party's claims offset those asserted by the governmental entity. And so here you have a situation where, you know, our claim for tortious interference is based on the SBEDC trying to go after our rent from our subtenants. And at the same time, the SBEDC has a counterclaim saying those rents are ours. So both can't be true. Only one can be true. You can't be
those rents. Aren't those rents due to the allegedly to the EDC because of the contract? And there's also a breach of contract claim.
I agree that there is a breach of contract claim. I don't think that just because they're asserting there is a breach that makes it so that all of a sudden it becomes due to them. But I would disagree with that. But
I think you're saying it's more connected with the tortious interference, which opens the door to waive the immunity.
Correct. I mean, yes. At the point that you are bringing counterclaims, and through those counterclaims, you're saying, I want these specific damages that are these rents that are being paid today. And at the same time, we're bringing a tortious interference claim that says you are tortiously interfering because you're trying to take our rent. and you don't have a right to do that. You don't have a contractual justification to do that. You don't have a privilege to do that. Those are competing claims. And so there is a waiver there. You know, it was argued in the reply brief that there is no waiver because they're distinguishable in time, that they are complaining about conduct that happened before a breach or at the time of a breach, and that our tortious interference claim is post-breach conduct and somehow just unrelated. There's various problems with that argument. One, it presupposes that there has been a breach. It's trying to draw a line in time of pre-breach and post-breach. And again, we're saying we haven't breached. But I do want to provide the court with one case citation that if I had filed a surreply, I would have talked about this case at length. And the citation is 226 Southwest 3rd 584. And it's Sweeney Community Hospital versus Menendez, the Menendez opinion. And this opinion is remarkable. What happens here is you have a community hospital that enters into a two-year contract with a doctor. They ask the doctor, okay, for 2 years, you need to open up a clinic in this rural community, and we'll pay you money. We'll do certain things to make sure it's economically viable that you have a practice out here. The doctor closed up the clinic within 2 years, and the community hospital then sues the doctor for breach of contract. The doctor then responds and says, okay, well, I'm going to counterclaim and I'm going to sue you for breach of contract. There were certain things you were supposed to do so that this clinic could be make money and you didn't do it. But I'm also going to sue you for tortious interference and I'm going to sue you for defamation because you've been going around and you've been telling other hospitals where I'm trying to get employment that I'm a guy who breaches contracts with hospitals and it's interfering with my ability to get employment. And so the community hospital files a plea to the jurisdiction and they say to the trial court, we're not going to touch his opposing breach of contract claim, but his defamation and his tortious interference claims, those need to go because they are different in time. And it's the exact same argument that he's been raising to this court. What they're saying there is that we're talking about a breach and he's talking about post-breach stuff. And in fact, some of the things that he's complaining about in his tortious interference claim are actions that we took outside of that two-year contractual window, so they're completely unrelated. The trial court denied the plea to the jurisdiction, said, you know, these tort claims are related, goes up on appeal, and it goes to the 14th Court of Appeals, the 2007 opinion, and the 14th Court of Appeals affirms and says, look, they are related. They're completely intertwined because the basis, you cannot succeed on your tortious interference claim, and you cannot succeed on your defamation claim unless you establish that you, in fact, did not breach your contract, that what they're saying about you is not true. And so that completely goes to the hospital's breach of contract claim. So because there's these common elements and one cannot be right, they both can't be right at the same time, there's a waiver here.
So we'll look at that, but I do want to hear from you regarding the injunction and the claim that because they filed their appeal to the denial of the plea to the jurisdiction that all other proceedings thereafter should be stayed.
Right.
And then, therefore, the injunction invalid. Y'all have to go back and do it all over again.
Right. So what you had here is you had the trial court say orally, I'm going to deny the plea to the jurisdiction. Within 1 minute, if you just the time, you know, it's one page to the next on the transcript. He says, you know what, I'm rescinding that. And that is completely proper. Trial courts retain their power over interlocutory orders, and he had every right to go ahead and rescind it. And so at that point, I mean, first of all, they would need to prove that within that 1 minute span of time, they filed their notice of appeal, which there's no proof of that. I mean, the reality is that they filed it after it was already orally rescinded. So there was nothing there to appeal. So that's problematic. Next is that they say, well, you know, we think that it was, you know, at some points in their brief, they say, well, it was a refusal to rule. I mean, a refusal to rule is not something that you address through an interlocutory appeal. If it's a refusal to rule, you address it through a mandamus.
They called it an implicit denial.
It's not an implicit denial. There's a case law that's cited in our brief that says the granting of a temporary injunction is not a comment on the merits. And also, you got to remember that tortious interference, they were only attacking one claim. We still had multiple claims that were going to be left untouched. And so there was still reason to entertain the temporary injunction, even if the court agreed with them that there was an issue with the tortious interference. Even if they were just, the court was to say, you know what? I agree with you. You are immune from this tortious interference claim. The court would still have reason to entertain the temporary injunction because there's other claims that are still surviving. The last point I want to make, I got 40 seconds here, is to say the issue about the service on these representatives, it's a complete red herring. It would make sense if I was here saying, okay, my temporary injunction hinges on my ability to bring a claim against, you know, this one of the names, Joe Navarro, who's a city commissioner. But the injunction doesn't hinge on that. It just hinges on having a valid claim against the SBEDC. SBEDC was properly served, and under the rules of civil procedure, you're allowed, a trial court is allowed to enjoin parties, and those parties' agents and their employees and their officers, and that's exactly what we did. For all those reasons.
Aren't you also claiming that some of the EDC board members and city commissioners committed ultra-virus acts that wouldn't make them agents of the city or EDC themselves if they're acting outside the scope of their
there is that allegation, yes. I'm not taking the position in the pleading that everything they've done that we're complaining about is necessarily outside. And at the end of the day, we're not so much governed by the pleadings, but we're governed by the evidence at the hearing. In the hearing, you have testimony that establishes that these people the complaint of acts are done in their capacity as SBEDC directors and as, you know, city commissioners who are aligned with the SBEDC.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to be brief, but just respond to some of the arguments made with respect to Rosenberg. Again, Rosenberg made some sweeping statements, but they specifically say in the beginning of Rosenberg, it says, this is the court saying this, the immunity issue on appeal is limited to Imperial's breach of contract and declaratory judgment claims, which were about the breach of contract. I mean, they start off their opinion by saying that. And then they jump to, well, we think this statute, again, it hasn't been briefed about the Tort Claims Act. We think this statute only applies to limitation on liability, not suit. But what they also say is they want to be very clear. We are not holding or ruling as to whether the legislature can grant immunity to an entity like the EDC by declaring it a governmental entity for purposes of the Tort Claims Act. They explicitly say they're not addressing that. And that's the argument, is that 505-106B, specifically the legislature has said, EDCs are governmental entities with immunity pursuant to the Tort Claims Act. And the Supreme Court in Rosenberg specifically said, we're not deciding that. They do go on to give these sweeping statements about immunity, which is unfortunate, but I do not believe that door is closed. The concurring opinion in Hitchcock, the justice is begging, inviting the Supreme Court, please clarify this, because the way I read this statute, they do have immunity from intentional torts, the same way Justice Heck did. So it does need to go to the Supreme Court. He's right, my firm handled Hitchcock. He's right, the briefing is the same as in this case. And it's going to be the same in probably every other circuit where this issue comes up and goes up. And it will keep coming up until the Supreme Court clarifies it. Briefly on the waiver argument, if their claim, I mean, there's more than tortious interference. They're bringing a civil conspiracy claim, which is a standalone claim. That claim has to do with the stop work order issued by the city. There is no, the Riata test isn't a blanket test that says, well, if you bring in your own intentional tort, immunity is waived for everything. It's an offset test. It says immunity is waived for claims that you bring that offset the damages that the governmental entity is bringing. It's a narrow test related to an offset. There is no offset. There's not even a scintilla of an offset of damages with respect to anything that the EDC is claiming and this stop work order claim of damages. Same with the rental issue. If they want to say to us now that our intentional tort as to tortious interference with contract on the rental issue, we're only limiting the damages. All we want is whatever y'all collect in rent, we think we're entitled to. We'll drop that issue. I'll agree with them on that claim if they're going to stipulate those are the damages. They haven't done that. In fact, in their request for the injunction, they say those damages aren't even calculable to us at this point. They say they're not putting a cap on that in any way. And because they haven't done that, they can't fit that within that narrow Riata waiver. It's just not there. I wanted, Justice Fonseca, when you mentioned about the limit, what we're bringing, whether it's a immunity issue on liability and suit, we're bringing both. You're right. There is we've argued it as to liability and suit. They've only countered as to suit, so that's kind of what we've been going forward. But we have that raised that issue in the brief as to both. I want to end on the Rosenberg case because I do think it is so important. It's going to be hard. I admit it's going to be hard for a court of appeals to say we know what Rosenberg said, but we think it's either dicta or an advisory opinion because that issue wasn't before the court at that time. But I think that is a viable opinion for a court of appeals to say. I can tell you, if you look at Westlaw, and I know Westlaw is not the be-all, end-all, but if you look there, there's no red flag saying, with respect to Westlaco versus Bourne, there is not a red flag that says overruled by Rosenberg. There's a yellow flag that merely says it was distinguished by Hitchcock. And I think Westlaw took that approach for the same reason that I believe that Rosenberg has not shut that door. It has for breach of contract. It has not shut that door for intentional torts. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Nothing.
No? Your time will expire in 2 seconds.
Timed it perfectly.
Thank you all. This case will be under submission. Thank you.
Thank you.